Hi, and welcome to Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. I'm Chris Garlock. The Labor Radio Podcast Weekly is a collection of highlights from labor radio and podcast shows around the country, part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network of more than two dozen shows focusing on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows at dclabor.org. Click on Union City Radio. This week, America's Workforce talks with retired painter Bob Swanson about mental health in the construction trades.
The culture in the construction industry, and whether it's female or male, I call it the tough guy or macho culture. If somebody says, I need to go to the doctor for a back injury or back problems, we don't have any problem with that. But if somebody says, geez, I need to go see my psychiatrist, we go, whoa, something's wrong with this guy.
Yeah,
we got to quit doing that.
Plus, on Your Rights at Work, retired nurse and novelist Tim Sheard visits a New York City hospital.
Death's wings have scattered the virus like fine snowflakes over every computer, keyboard, and phone, and countertop and chair.
And historian Steve Frazier discusses the pandemic, workers, and the current state of capitalism.
It's a kind of mystery, one of the great mysteries of human history, about when people rise up. And the other side of that mystery is why they don't rise up much more frequently than they do.
That's all ahead on this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Enjoy the show. America's Workforce broadcasts every weekday out of Cleveland, Ohio, where the show has been on the air since 1993. Hosted by Ed Flash Ferenx, the America's Workforce supplies listeners with useful, relevant input into their daily lives through fact-finding features, in-depth interviews, informative news segments, and practical consumer reports. The topic on a recent show was mental health in the construction trades with Bob Swanson, a retired painter whose son died from suicide in 2009. Ed spoke with Bob about the stigma that surrounds mental health while working in the construction trades.
Good afternoon and welcome back to America's Workforce broadcast from Ohio for workers around the entire world. And we're archived on awfradio.com. Let's go to line number one. And joining us from Minneapolis is Bob Swanson. And Bob is here to talk about suicide prevention, especially when it comes to the construction trades. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, Bob is a suicide loss survivor. His oldest son died by suicide at the age of 33, and this was in March of 2009. And he comes from the trades. In fact, you're a retired painting contractor, Bob. Is that correct? You were in the field for a lot of years.
That is correct. Yep.
Okay. Good. Good. How long were you working in the trades?
I had 45 years of experience in the construction industry. Started as a painter, and also worked as a instructor of apprentices. And then I became involved in a family business. The last 25 years, I was president of the company.
Okay, good, good, good. So you had a very successful life. It's unfortunate for the loss of your son, but that propelled you into a different career here. And I know you've been doing a lot of talking, especially to the trades. Let's talk about the trades. And I guess, and I was reading some of the numbers here, which are really startling. The rate of suicide in the trades is, what, four times that the national average? Is that correct?
Very close to four times the national average, Ed. Yes, that's correct.
And can you speculate as to why? I know this is dangerous. It's hard work and all that. There's good pay. There's good benefits. But what do you attribute that to?
Well, from my experience in the industry, there's four or five factors I contribute it to. One is the culture in the construction industry, and whether it's female or male, I call it the tough guy or macho culture. Construction is a tough industry. It's a service industry. And every day, I call every day game day. So everybody has to be on the top of their game every day. And because of that, nobody wants to be taken off the team, so to speak. I like to talk in sports analogies. And so people show up, even though they're not at top shape, they're vulnerable, and they don't want to indicate their vulnerability because they may lose their job. They may lose some time on the job. So they just tough it out. So that's probably the biggest factor. But then our industry, because we're service industry, and unfortunately, I would ask people to work goofy hours, many hours out of town. That all puts stress on the family. And I spent a lot of time out of town myself. It's not what it's cracked up to be. It's lonely. There's a lot of distractions. You're away from your support of your family. And if you have some mental health issues or substance use issues, you're away from your support. Because we work a lot of long hours sometimes on projects, sleep deprivation is critical. And then it's a physical industry. Over time, there's chronic pain, and people just keep toughing it out. Well, if you're going to keep toughing it out, then you've got issues initially of maybe over-the-counter medications, then it's prescription drugs. And because our industry is very accepting of the use of alcohol, at some point there, use of alcohol or illicit drugs. And then a big issue is financial stress. We're not an industry where you're guaranteed employment. Our industry ebbs and flows due to projects. And when projects get completed, even though a person's worked hard and done everything well, they might lose their job. And sometimes there's long periods of no employment. So you throw all those things together, and then the general population, which we're part of, roughly 20% of the adult population in the United States is living with some sort of mental illness. And if you're toughing it out and not getting the care you need, that can lead to bad things. So it's kind of a summary, Ed, of why I think our industry is different.
Yeah, you know, there's a stigma of mental illness in America. I'm just wondering, is that changing? What's your thoughts on that? And I know that figure, 20, that's one out of five people. One out of five people suffering from some form of mental illness. How do you think America is handling that today?
I think we're in denial. And because of that, there's a lot of stigma, shame around that. So what happens, and I can just use our own son. When we discovered he was living with a mental illness, we didn't broadcast it. We didn't tell friends. We didn't even tell very many family members because it's not something you can put your finger on. It was confusing, and there was a lot of shame. We were ashamed of it. Which, what illness do you know of where you're ashamed your loved one has the illness? I don't know of any other than mental illnesses, and that prevents somebody from getting the help they need. And then we have a total lack of facilities. I can remember back with our son one time when we needed some help. It was like 12, 16 weeks to get a doctor appointment. Well, what illness do you know of where you're going to wait 12 or 16 weeks to get a doctor appointment? I don't know of any.
Right.
So we're understaffed with mental health facilities, but the stigma and shame play a big role.
You mentioned drugs, and I bring to the conversation the opioid crisis, which we're still in the midst of. I think it's leveled off a little bit. Did that accelerate things for the trades members who were suffering from this?
You know, I don't know, Ed, if there's a correlation. So here's where I'd go with that. Our son, one illness he lived with was abuse of alcohol, and he at one time he went in for inpatient treatment. And I remember the inpatient person, I said, I don't know if my son's in the right place because he lives with some mental illnesses. And the intake person told me that most people that have a substance use issue also have a mental health issue. They kind of go together. So in answer to your question, Ed, I don't know if it's accelerated things. And a lot of times we don't know the cause of death, if it was an overdose or if it was a suicide. That's kind of a tricky thing to figure out.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bob, you've been going around the country talking about this subject, primarily to members of the trades. How, let me ask you, how long you've been doing this? I guess this is something that you, obviously, since you were personally touched, your family was personally touched, you're very passionate about this issue. Maybe you can talk about the structure of what you've put together to help our brothers and sisters in the trades.
Well, typically, and my talks vary from, a half hour to an hour. I typically go over statistics. The one is, 20% of adults live with a mental illness of some kind. I talk about our industry, why, which we've talked about some of those things. But what I spend more time on is, what do we need to do about it? And I like to offer some hope, because I believe we can do something about it. And some of it's terminology. So we often say people commit suicide. And this is my opinion, but I feel strongly my son didn't want to die. And I use the term his illness caused his death. And therefore, I say he died by suicide or died from suicide. And back to the opioid a little bit, I would submit, as long as we say commit suicide, we blame them for their death. We didn't blame anybody for their death with the opioids, and partly how we started reducing that, we blamed the pharmaceutical companies, and we blamed the doctors, and now we're seeing a slight decrease in opiate deaths, and I think it will continue that way. Where suicides, we haven't seen any decrease at all. It's going up every year. So that's one thing. It's terminology. Another terminology, and I talked, it just changes the way you look at things, is people live with a mental illness. So we typically say he's bipolar. That blames them for the disease, and it increases the shame and the stigma. We don't say somebody is cancer. We say they live with cancer. Somebody lives with these diseases, they're just illnesses. It's nobody's fault. So I try to, and then I go into, what can we do about it? A big thing, I use safety. This is a safety and health issue. So in my experience in the trades, in the 60s and 70s, we accepted fatalities on job sites. We no longer do that. In the 80s, we accepted injuries on all job sites. We don't do that anymore. We now are in zero injury, and that we're even tracking near misses. So we made it a real need. We saw a need, and we took action. We have to do the same thing with this. So we need to make it acceptable to talk about these things. And that starts with the, typically, I would say, the union officials, but more importantly, the contractors and owners. Do they create an environment where somebody can talk about, hey, I'm having issues, I need help, and provide the help without any shame. And so often, if somebody says, I need to go to the doctor for a back injury or back problems, we don't have any problem with that. But if somebody says, geez, I need to go see my psychiatrist, we go, whoa, something's wrong with this guy.
Yeah,
we got to
yeah.
quit doing that. And I think it starts, what I'm seeing and when I speak to, another thing, when I speak to people afterwards, people will come up and tell me their stories, and they'll say, I've never been able to say this to anybody. So we got to create a word safe to talk about it. And
that's right.
Those are all things I really stress in my presentations.
We're going to get into some more details. You can stay with us for another segment here, Bob.
Yes, I can.
Very good. His name is Bob Swanson, retired painting contractor, and he's affiliated with the Finishing Contractors Association International. The website, by the way, is finishingcontractors.org, finishingcontractors.org. Also, later in the broadcast, Elizabeth Leamy will be joining us talking about the dangers in your home. A lot of products may be hurting you. We'll talk about it right here on America's Workforce, back in a few minutes. Good afternoon and welcome back to America's Workforce Broadcast from Ohio for workers around the entire world. And we're archived on AWFradio.com. Let's go back to our live line. Rejoin Bob Swanson. Bob is a suicide loss survivor. His oldest son died by suicide about 11 years ago. And as a result, he's been frequently speaking on a national basis, I might add, to construction industry groups. In case you're just tuning in right now, in the trades, the suicide rate is four times higher than the national average. Bob, I was going to ask you here about the coronavirus situation. I know this has just kind of made things worse in America. Now, I don't know what it is. You're in Minneapolis. Here in Ohio, construction is deemed an essential service. Essential. And there's some non-essential businesses. They're at home right now. I'm just wondering, is that putting added pressure on this? I mean this is relatively new now, this virus, and it's shutting down a big chunk of America. But don't you think this is going to make matters worse for those who are reporting for work? Any thoughts on that?
Oh, I think this whole environment right now is probably putting great pressure on a lot of people. Let's face it. Fear of their jobs. Am I going to still work? I have financial commitments. Is my family safe? Are they okay? Am I bringing it home to my family? There's got to be tremendous anxiety of people that are working and, of course, the ones that aren't. It's, I'm very concerned. And I would think I get information from the National Alliance of Mental Illness, NAMI, and because they're primarily working from home, their services are limited. Social services are limited. I think this is very critical for a lot of people.
Now, you put out a monthly email about suicide prevention, and I saw one of the blogs, too. You're Not Alone, a mental health and suicide prevention blog for the construction industry. And you paint a scenario. I read part of it at the beginning of the show, What Do I Do Now? And you pretty much touched on this. If you're in the trades and you see your coworker bleeding, right away you'd say, hey, you know, we got to get you to the ER. Things are not good here. We'll take care of it. And apparently you have to use that same line of thinking if somebody is having suicidal thoughts. And I guess that message, that's the message that has to resonate in the trades, right?
Yes. So when I speak, and I guess it's just natural for me, I like to talk about things that I think resonate with both contractors and employees in the industry, and that seems to resonate. The big thing is people that are living with a mental illness, because of the shame, they wear a mask. So let me again go back to my son. If he was here and Ed walked in your office, he'd have a smile on his face. It's a mask. So you have to react to the actions that the person's taking versus the way they look. And people mm-hmm. think, well, it looked fine. I've heard that too many times when people regret, geez, I wish we would have done something. We thought he was fine. Well, you got to look at the clues of potential mental crisis or potential suicide. And we kind of, there's three general categories. There's some verbal clues, and there's behavioral clues, and then there's situational clues. And I don't know if you want me to go into that a little bit, but
sure, that's
part
go ahead.
Of my presentation also.
Okay. No, we have time to do that. That's what this show is all about. We want to take it a little a step further than normal radio. Let's start with the verbal part.
So verbal clues are things like somebody saying, I'm just a burden. I wish I was dead. Nobody cares about me. Just things like that. You're saying, whoa, these aren't normal normal things a person says. They're losing hope. And you need to react to that and take it seriously. So a big kind of misnomer is, well, they're just looking for attention. No, they're not. They're saying, I'm bleeding. I need help, mm-hmm. versus, they're just looking for attention. And then some behavioral clues, a lot of anger, a lot of agitation, maybe more use of alcohol or drugs, excessive sleep, lack of sleep, The guy that was always on the job is now showing up late, angry, you know, what's going on, guy? You know, you're not your normal self. And then situational clues, which would be really big today, you lose your job, you lose a relationship. Now you're losing, and you have financial stress. Now you're losing not only hope, but control of your life. And I can go into, if you'd like, just some little steps of what you should do if you see somebody in those situations, because that's, again, part of my presentation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's touch on that. I mean, at that point, I mean, we're talking, that's a critical stage, it would seem to me. Well, what should somebody do when they're confronted with that?
So part of it, I go back again to the use of bleeding. So if you see somebody with a cut finger, that's a basic first aid. You give them the attention they need, and they go back to work. Well, in the other hand, so the same with that. If you sense, boy, lately something's kind of wrong, you approach the person, and it's a one-on-one conversation. Because of the shame, you don't blurt it out in front of the whole crew. And you say, you know, I'm really concerned about you. You're not showing up to work. Your attitude isn't what it is normally. Can we talk? And hopefully you can break through it. But you want to really make sure they understand you care about them. And then no judgment. That's huge in this. You listen with no judgment. Because the person might say, you know, back to those verbal clues, I'm no good to anybody. I wish you were dead. At that point, you don't want to say, geez, I can't even imagine how you can say those things, because then it will shut down the conversation. And then basically you're assessing how serious is this. And if you really are concerned, this is now like a major bleeding where you need to call 911, then that's what you should do. So it's or do you just need to get that person, your union employee assistance program, you make the call right then and there. So the key to this is you don't say, well, tomorrow I'll talk to him. Tomorrow can be too late. Most of these clues, the person's putting together an idea already, and most suicides, from the idea to actually doing it, is an hour or less. It's not like they think about it for weeks on end. So it's serious to take some action right away.
Yeah, we should give out some phone numbers here. The National Suicide Crisis, there's hotline, and we're talking a hotline that's staffed by mental health professionals 24/7. The number is 800-273-8255, and that spells out TALK, 8255. 800-273-TALK, 800-273-8255. You can also text HOME, 741-741. Text HOME to 741-741. Again, this is 24/7. So there is help for people that are contemplating suicide. Bob, one more question here. How are you being received on this? You've been doing this for quite some time. As I indicated, you're very dedicated. You're very passionate about what you're doing. And this touches home for you. The reception that you're getting around the country, how's that going for you?
People are very happy to talk about this. Once they make the decision, they're going to make it a priority. So it's changed over the last few years. There used to be a lot of hesitancy. Now I'm welcomed. And like I say, people will come up afterwards, want to talk to me. I'll get phone calls later. People wondering what to do, and I'm not a mental health professional, so I kind of go, here's some resources, and guide it that way. But I would say it's a topic people are starting to want to talk about in their safety and health meetings, and I get good responses also on my blog. So people are more and more becoming aware of it and more concerned about it and realize they can do something about it. Suicides are preventable. We just all have to take action when it's required.
Yeah, yeah. Again, that hotline number, 1-800-273-8255, 273-8255. Text HOME to 741-741. Also want to drive you to the blog here, finishingcontractors.org. That's the main website. /prevent suicide, and you could listen to what Bob has to say. Bob, I thank you so much for your time, your passion on this whole subject here. I know it's almost therapy for you, since you lost your son some years ago, I would imagine.
This is part of my healing, and I'm a man of faith. The first 4 or 5 years, I was angry, ashamed, guilty, all those things. And I prayed, what am I supposed to do about it? And I've been given that you need to talk about it and help others. So that's what I've been trying to do the last 5 years. So it is part of my healing. I'll never be healed, but it's part of my healing.
There you go. Bob, you take care. God bless you. Keep up what you're doing, and let's stay in touch on the show here. We got a big audience of the trades here in northeastern Ohio, plus we're podcast nationally to many of the trades, and that includes our presenting sponsor, Labor's International. So you take care, okay?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Retired painter Bob Swanson on America's Workforce. Find out more at awfradio.com. On the latest Your Rights at Work show here in Washington, D.C., I talked with Tim Sheard, a former nurse who's now a publisher and author of 9 novels featuring Lenny Moss, a crime-solving nurse. Tim's latest is All Bleeding Stops Eventually, and he also just published a nonfiction report at laborpress.com entitled Condition Critical, New York City Nurse Issues Harrowing Report from the Medical Frontlines. This is Your Rights at Work with Chris Garlock and Ed Smith. I've been trying to get Tim on for a couple of weeks here, and finally we decided, we're going to take a little bit of a break from the COVID-19 coverage, although actually it's not really a break because Lenny Moss, of course, is a nurse. So we're not too far from the current situation. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Hey, before we get started, can you do a little reading from your – you had a wonderful piece recently that you published, and it reads, frankly, it's nonfiction, but it reads like fiction. Could you do a little reading from that?
This is a nurse in the intensive care unit. Nurse T goes into a small room. One of the night nurses is yelling at a young baby-faced intern to come help. Her patient is crashing and about to code. But the intern is afraid to leave his safe island in the doctor's report room. He knows that the COVID-19 virus is everywhere. Death's wings have scattered the virus like fine snowflakes over every computer, keyboard, and phone, and countertop and chair. The attending and the fellow join the nurse, the intern slowly following them into the room.
I mean, you make a pandemic sound poetic, bro.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you, Chris. I'm trying to bring the reality of their situation to the public. So it's maybe we can rally more support for more resources to be sent, for the government to send more resources to New York and other areas that are stricken.
Well, and you are up in the New York area, which, of course, is an epicenter of the pandemic. And just remind folks, you were not always a publisher and an author.
I'm a retired nurse with 42 years of hospital duty. And when my 2 sons were old enough that I can park them in front of the TV and ignore them, I started writing stories about my favorite patients and my favorite coworkers in the hospital, as I wanted to show the world what hospital workers do. I wanted to show their humanity and their courage and their dedication. And so it kind of evolved from there, and I've been writing them for about 30 years now.
Well, and they're wonderful. But the thing is, I've just known you from your novels, and here you are doing nonfiction. It's just sort of an interesting collision of your real world and the fiction world and the pandemic.
It really is. And if you believed in mystical forces govern our lives, which I don't, but if you did, you could say that my years of writing medical fiction has prepared me for writing these stories today. It's like put me in the perfect place to be the spokesperson for these hospital workers.
One of the things that we're obviously very concerned with is what's happening in New York. I do have a nurse that used to work at Howard University Hospital that is working up in New York, and she said basically she's never seen anything like this. Tell me what you're hearing, anything different?
Well, we hope that we may have reached a plateau in the admissions. That's not a plateau in the deaths, because the deaths occur after admission, but we're hoping that the social distancing and the shutdown of schools and businesses is helping to flatten the curve. But even with that, a lot of the hospitals are literally overrun with patients. They're telling people now, don't come to the hospital unless your lips are blue and you can't get a breath. And they're in a desperate situation. The nurses and staff get one N95 masks for a 12-hour shift. In some places, they're even washing them and rinsing them in antiseptic and reusing them the next day. And there's just a shortage of drugs. They don't have enough equipment. They don't have enough staff. Half of the housekeepers are out sick. Many of these hospitals are not hiring temps. There are lots of people out of work who would be willing to risk working in the hospital through a temp agency. But again, the hospitals are strapped for money, and the federal government is not sending them cash. They need money now because they need to hire more people, even more people than they normally do, with so many people out sick.
Tim Sheard on Your Rights at Work. Our next guest was historian Steve Frazier, author of Mongrel Firebugs and Men of Property, Capitalism and Class Conflict in American History.
Let's add another voice to this conversation, and that's Steve Frazier, also up there in the New York area, as it happens. He's the author of a whole bunch of books. Steve is the king of the great title, actually, the great title and the great subtitle. His latest book, Mongrel Firebugs and Men of Property, Capitalism and Class Conflict in American History. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me on your show.
You are really a master book titler, I have to tell you. Let me just give people a few other examples. Wall Street, America's Dream Palace, The Age of Acquiescence, The Life and Death of American Resistance to Organize Wealth and Power. I mean, these are just books that I just want to read from the title alone, but you're the preeminent historian for the left and labor in this country. And you write a lot about capitalism, which, you know, I'm no historian, but it seems to me like capitalism is a bit of a pickle at the moment. What do you think?
Yeah, some more dramatic word than pickle, I think, would have to describe the situation. It's really, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen. Look, you know, in a way, it was already in a pickle, so to speak. You know, on the one hand, the economy, Trump's economy, has been described for a long time until recently as a boom economy, but that boom has really mainly benefited a very thin sliver of the population, those who are already possessed of a lot of wealth and as a consequence a lot of power, and a lot of the boom has been based on low wage labor, full employment, but remarkable low numbers in unemployment, but based on low wage labor. And now, of course, the situation has changed, and that's dramatically. And nobody knows what's the long term. I believe, although I don't know that I could defend this, that this will last for a very long time, that there were already weakening signs of the economy before the virus hit. The whole world is going to be in a deep recession, I think depression. It'll make the Great Recession of 10 years ago seem like child's play in comparison, and it'll be a long time hauling our way out of this, and who knows what the consequences of that will be, both politically and economically.
Well, you had a terrific interview in Jacobin recently, and one of the things that you talked about there, so when people rise up or don't rise up, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is an interesting question in history, and particularly, you know, for those of us interested in labor history, right? I mean, sometimes workers rise up, as in the last couple of years, you know, with teachers and so forth, and sometimes they don't. And I guess one of the things that I've been thinking about as we're going through this current crisis, it's not always obvious what prompts people to rise up or to resist. And I was wondering what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's a kind of mystery, one of the great mysteries of human history, about that, about when people rise up, and the other side of that mystery, as I think about it, is why they don't rise up much more frequently than they do, given the kinds of indignities and abuses and exploitation that have been the lot of most of, say, in American history. Most working people in American history have suffered all kinds of oppressions and exploitation and material deprivations, and yet have not risen up. And then all of a sudden, as you suggest, they do. I wish I could say to you there's a kind of iron law of rebellion and acquiescence that would allow you to predict when you would get rebellion and when you're likely to get acquiescence. I don't think there is. I think every situation is unique historically. You know, who could have possibly predicted, someone might have, but the Bernie Sanders phenomenon 10 years ago. I don't think anybody really could honestly say they thought that America, especially in America, given its love affair with capitalism, its love affair with Wall Street, which had gone on for 20, 25 years, you know, living through this Gilded Age, this second Gilded Age that we've been living through, where the very notion of a democratic socialist becoming a popular political figure was unthinkable, unimaginable, has been so probably since the Cold War. Didn't used to be so in American history, but certainly has been so for the last half century or 75 years. And yet, you get the Great Recession, and we can maybe attribute this phenomenon to that, the Great Recession of 2008 and so on. And then after that, the Occupy Wall Street movement and the beginnings of a kind of restiveness and a new generation of precarious working people, especially young people, students heavily in debt, headed for dead-end jobs or no jobs at all. And that seems to have laid, I guess, the groundwork for the Bernie Sanders phenomenon and for all the other, as you alluded to, the kinds of new restiveness among working people. And yet, we still are in a situation in which a tiny fraction of the labor forces belongs to unions, a fraction of what used to be easily 35% of the labor force belonged to unions. Now, you know, in the private sector, less probably than 8% do, and we've lived that way for a long time, and there are reasons that account for that, but we're still in a situation in which, although things are happening, teachers are striking, fast food workers are organizing, and so on and so forth, we're still a long way from where we once were and where we need to be in order to rectify what goes on in this capitalist economy today in America.
So as we kind of slowly get out of this emergency in the next, hopefully, couple of months, we're going to be going back to work, and there are going to be cities that have deficits, in some cases massive deficits. There will be also states that have problems. So how do we get to further the discussion of things like Medicare for All or things that support the working class in the country, given the fact that we're going to be very, very much in the weeds or in the red when we come out of this?
Right. Well, I think one thing we need to do is to use the virus, the pandemic, as a kind of spotlight on what has been festering in the American economy for a very long time, because it reveals how vulnerable we are, not just medically, and obviously, as Sanders reiterates over and over again, we're the only advanced industrial society not to have universal medical care, but the virus has revealed not only our weakened medical system, its incapacities, but also how vulnerable people are in every conceivable way, so that And the virus helps to illuminate that. So, for example, as has been true in natural disasters all throughout American history, they're never entirely natural. They reveal the social anatomy of the society we're living in. So today, who are naturally the worst, most likely to get sick? It's the most impoverished. It's African Americans. It's people living in neighborhoods where the nutritional resources are minimal, where the health resources are minimal, where people have to go to work. They don't have the option of working from home. They can't give up their jobs if they still have jobs because they can't afford that. So in a way, we need to start with what the virus has illuminated about about how our society is organized to benefit and to take care of and to protect the needs of the most privileged and the wealthiest, and has neglected the needs of the vast majority of working people. It means also that we have to reverse our priorities. Instead of spending billions and billions of dollars to bail out financial institutions, airlines, and so on and so forth, we need to begin to spend the money to communally to take care of the common wealth, to ensure the well-being of everybody. That means whether that's building infrastructure or Medicare for all, or the Green New Deal, which could create millions, literally millions of new jobs, good-paying, high-skilled jobs. We need to put our capital resources. We need to have a government that has control over, a popular government that can control the direction in which our capital resources are used, so that they're not used for speculation, for mergers and acquisitions, for all the sundry uses that, you know, the venture capitalists and the hedge fund people, you know, make use of what are, after all, the common resources we all depend upon to live. And the virus can help us see that and maybe lead to a movement where we redirect those resources and establish a kind of authority, a democratic authority, to use our wherewithal, which is considerable, for the common good.
Historian Steve Fraser, author of Mongrel Firebugs and Men of Property, Capitalism and Class Conflict in American History. Your Rights at Work airs Thursdays at 1 p.m. on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. You can also listen to the podcast. Just search for Union City Radio. Hey, thanks for listening to Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights from shows around the country, part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network of more than 24 shows focusing on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows at dclabor.org. Click on Union City Radio. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local labor radio show.